Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's Tuesday. Really, it is. It's actually Tuesday. It's hard enough to know when the weekend starts and ends, but when you have one of these three-day weekends, it is more bizarre. However, this Memorial Day did feel different than a lot of other Memorial Days. We marked the marked some solemn milestones, including we are almost at 100,000 Americans who've died from the coronavirus. And over the weekend, it did seem like America decided collectively that, hey, we're done with this. We don't need to take it seriously. Let's go to the Lake of the Ozarks and jump in the pool or whatever was going on in Maryland. But just to put this in a little bit of context, the New York Times ran some numbers here that the death toll right now has nearly matched the number of people killed in the initial blasts of the world's first atomic bombs dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In terms of American deaths, it's the equivalent of 22 Iraq wars, 33 September 11th attacks, 41 Afghanistan wars, 42 Pearl Harbors, or 25,000 Benghazis. Interestingly enough, now I know you know all of this. The president spent a lot of the weekend tweeting, but he made no mention of the death toll on the coronavirus, and as usual, was not able to bring himself to express much sympathy or any empathy at all for the families and the victims. But he did find time to tweet out things implying that Stacey Abrams was Shamu. That was one of the retweets. Hillary Clinton was a skank. He misspelled the name of Congressman Connor Lamb, who is in fact an army veteran. Threatened North Carolina, and of course, spread a baseless and discredited smear going after Joe Scarborough and suggesting on multiple occasions that Joe Scarborough was involved in murdering a young woman. It's not true. It's been blown out of the water. Her death was an accident. She'd fainted, the result of a heart condition. Her head hit a desk. But there are a couple of developments on all of this, including the fact that her widower wrote a letter to the CEO of Twitter saying, I am asking you to intervene in this instance because the president of the United States has taken something that does not belong to him, the memory of my dead wife, and perverted it for perceived political gain. I would also ask that you consider Lori's niece and two nephews who will eventually come across this filth in the future. They've never met their aunt, and it pains me to think they would ever have to think about her in this way. My wife deserves better. So joining me today is the author of a bombshell story in The Atlantic about the manliness of Donald Trump, our good friend Tom Nichols. So, Tom, happy day after Memorial Day.
Good Lord. That was one of the longest Memorial Day weekends in everybody's life.
I wanted to check out. I swear, I really did want to check out over this weekend. And it's just like, you know, you're thinking about this and it just, it makes your eyes sort of burn that the president of the United States is tweeting, he's got a beef about Joe Scarborough. He doesn't like Joe Scarborough. You know, fine, whatever. But he's accusing him of murder. And everybody's sort of looking around going, you know, this is the president of the United States using his power. And the chief law enforcement officer in the country is saying we need to reopen the cold case. See, I words fail here, Tom, which is why I wanted to bring on a wordsmith.
Well, you know, more appropriate area of expertise here is Russian politics. I mean, yeah. This is the kind of stuff that would make Putin blush. You know, you said something bad about me on television, so I'm going to accuse you of murdering a young woman years ago, and I'm going to put the top prosecutor on it to try to, you know, destroy your life. And if that causes misery and grief to this, you know, this widower and to the people around her, this is beyond comprehension. And I am really, like you, I just wanted to kind of check out. I'm trying to work on this other book. I'm kind of being a scholar. I'm reading stuff. I'm taking notes. But I just was drawn back to it to say, because I'm angry now, and I'm angry at the people who are enabling Trump, because this really is, you always think that we finally hit that last moment, but this really is the moment where you want to look across these people and say, when is this enough for you? When does this stop? When are you finally going to recover? You know, I'm sorry. It's the McCarthy moment, you know,
Yeah.
No decency.
And we know the answer. Have you no sense of shame? We do know that. And now this is, I do feel that it is hard to come up with language because we feel like we've said this stuff. And I wrote my newsletter this morning. I mean, this is really the problem with a president who just regularly floods the zone with vileness. I mean, we get numbed. It starts to seem normal. And it's hard to find the language to call it what it is. So I put Nicholas Kristof's tweet in. He asked a great question. He says, what's the best way for President Trump's disgusting fabrication here that's so devastating to the woman's husband and family? Grotesque, vile, demented, scurrilous, monstrous, depraved, evil, loathsome. Not sure we have a word that captures the ugliness. And yeah.
Right. It's going to get worse. I mean, this is we're only 5.5 months out from an election that he seems to be on the verge of losing. And it's going to get worse. But just think, you know, your point is really well taken, Charlie. Think of how far we have come that we would have been shocked when a president said, you know, damn or hell. Or if a president, I mean, Barack Obama said something mildly critical of Fox News and we all lost our mind. I know I did. We all lost our minds saying the president of the United States cannot, you know, attacking the Fourth Estate, cannot pick favorites. We've become accustomed to this kind of lumbering swamp thing out of the tabloids who says whatever comes to mind hurts anybody he can reach by lashing out merely because that's what he wants to do for his own self-protection. And we like watching a child just smear his diapers all over the walls. We've just gotten used to it. We've just said, well, you know, that's what kids do. That's what he does. So, you know, no point in cleaning it up and no point in telling him not to. We might as well just live in a house with, you know, smeared poop all over the walls.
This may be an unpopular opinion and it may be misunderstood, but I guess part of me thinks this is not really about Twitter. We're having this big debate about what is Jack Dorsey going to do about this? Should they delete the tweets? Really, in the larger scheme of things, that's kind of a so what, because this is the president of the United States and he's behaving in this way. And if it's not on Twitter, it will be someplace else. And so the focus really ought to be on, as you put it, the enablers. Where's the Republican Party? Is there any Republicans? I mean, I see some folks on Twitter who are saying, you know, this is unseemly. I think maybe you should tweet more. You know, maybe she should golf more and tweet less. But you know that they're going to go back to the norm, which is they'll avert their eyes. They'll find some way to rationalize. And why are we not talking about what Joe Biden said on Friday? Joe Biden said, you ain't black. We should be talking about that. Okay, remember what that news cycle was like? Remember what Twitter was like about Joe Biden's gaffe? It was all day, all day, all day. Ari Fleischer, I'm incensed about this. Nikki Haley was deeply, deeply concerned about it.
She was wrestling with it. Nikki Haley had to wrestle with it and struggle. Man. I'm struggling with this.
And then Donald Trump dumps what? A shitload of stuff all weekend long. And this is the asymmetry. Because, you know, Biden's kind of treated as a normal human being, a normal politician who has to be accountable, held accountable for saying stupid things. That was a stupid thing. But since Trump is completely not normal, the media hasn't figured out, we haven't figured out how to handle a president who just spends the weekend, you know, in serial awfulness.
And you know, when you talk about the enablers and the Republicans, two things came to mind. One is this weekend more than ever, with Trump just crapping all over Memorial Day, you know, a really sacred day. I mean, both of my parents are veterans. My brother just passed away. As you know, he was a veteran. You know, this is one of those days where you just put this aside for a moment and he can't. He just has to dump all. Connor Lamb, by the way, Connor Lamb is a Marine. Charlie, he's not in the Army. Yeah. He's a Marine officer.
I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting.
And he, you know, to just go after him in this very personal way on Memorial Day is again, that unique thing about Trump where he says, I'm going to find the most transgressive thing and do it just to show you that I can, just because I know it will make everybody crazy. And the other thing that strikes me about this is that I feel, I've been on your show before and I've said, you know, I've lost friends over Trump. I argue with them. I feel like they are lost to me in some way. Something happened with me this weekend watching this Memorial Day nightmare that I don't even argue with the people who send me, you know, people, my friends who, you know, send me an email or a note or try to kind of get, I don't even bother responding to them now. I mean, they really are, you know, beyond after this weekend, instead of feeling like I need to either argue with them or shake my head at them, that they just don't, I don't want to say they're dead to me. I mean, nobody's dead to me, but they are, you know, I don't need their friendship. I mean, this is really a time for an important decision, and Memorial Day made it worse. There's something about this past 72 hours that just, I know that I've said this before, but this weekend, felt different to me.
It did to me too. It's funny you should say that. My wife and I were actually having this conversation, and I think that part of it is that it's not just Trump. It's your fellow Americans. They're looking at this, and are they going to be okay with this? Because
I don't feel like my fellow Americans right now.
Well, see, now that's kind of, you know, I think Christian Schneider had an interesting tweet. He said, I've sort of comforted myself thinking, well, okay, we have an ignoramus as president, but most Americans are decent and they're intelligent. And they, you know, when push comes to shove, they will do the right thing. And we have one another's back. And he says, I'm not sure I really feel that way anymore. So yeah, I know that sounds kind of dark. You know how bad this weekend was, though, in terms of the president's sort of lack of empathy? I mean, and this, by the way, is going to sound like I'm being snarky, but it's literally true that his behavior is so unsympathetic that even Ann Coulter is offended.
Yes. Stepping forward and saying, you know, for Ann Coulter to say, you know, I've really had it with your brutal, callous behavior is like, that's like Kim Jong-un stepping forward and saying, you know, you're being a little hard on the opposition here.
Yeah. Here's actually a tweet for people who think that we're exaggerating. Over the weekend, Ann Coulter, COVID gave Trump a chance to be a decent, compassionate human being, or pretending to be, but he couldn't even do that. And then she goes on to say that he's the most disloyal actual retard that's ever set foot in the Oval Office. If only someone had warned her.
Yeah, if only she hadn't written a whole book telling us that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, you know you're in a really deep, dark place when Ann Coulter is accusing you of lacking compassion and maybe being a little bit racist. I mean, you know, oh, by the way, speaking of which, have you followed this Michelle Malkin thing?
We're talking about, of course, our friend Jonah Goldberg, who was attacked by her and, you know, fired back. Yes, I watched the whole thing. I have the same feeling about her that I did. And I said this on Twitter when Tommy Lahren was, you know, talking about how great it was that COVID finally revealed who the real, you know, men and women among us are. All I could think of with Malkin and Lahren is what has to go so wrong in your life that you're capable of talking this way? What happened? What terrible defect?
Well,
leads you down that road. And I just don't, I mean, she's a horrible person. I mean, she just that, you know,
well, she's also, I mean, you've followed her career in the past. I mean, she's actually quite intelligent. She's literate. She can use, you know, words. Yep. Yeah. She did not used to be this way. And now she's gone off into defending actual white supremacists, Holocaust deniers. I mean, it is really dark and ugly. And what a strange development that Newsmax would have decided to bring her on staff. The rest of the conservative movement is in the process of going, okay, Michelle, you've gone too far. You really have. There is no place for being a Holocaust denier. There is no place for somebody who is praising Nick Fuentes and the other, you know, actual raw, not a gray line white supremacist. And then last week, the president tweeted her name out, and then she gets hired by Newsmax. So this is what's happening. But, you know, going to the whole point of what Trump does to people, let me just read you one of her tweets today. And again, you have to, in order to really fully understand this, I mean, Michelle Malkin did not used to be like this and used to, you know, I think she had a syndicated column. And coming up on Newsmax in about 15 minutes to talk about blah, 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 and the disgusting slob Jonah dispatches slobby attack on press secretary. Which just sounds like a freaking eight-year-old. Well, yep. I mean, Michelle, use your words. You used to be able to write without sounding like a complete idiot. Slobby, slob, poopy head.
Yeah. You know, it's because we're fat or something.
I don't know. It's so bad.
You know, there's two things going on here. And I'm glad you brought up that she was, that she is smart and that she didn't used to be this way, because increasingly when it comes to some of our old comrades on the right, someone will tweet at me and say, can you believe what, you know, this person, they're so stupid. And I always feel the need to correct them. You know, when somebody like Sean Davis says something nutty and people tell me, Sean is not stupid. I mean, these are smart people. They are highly intelligent. I mean, I worked with these people. I enjoyed working with these people. These are smart people. And that's what makes it worse. That's the thing that really makes it terrible, because, you know, you look at a guy like, who's the guy that looks like Max Headroom? Looks like he's from.
Bill Mitchell.
Bill Mitchell, right. You know, you can look at that guy and say, look, he's just dumb. And you know, he's just a guy who's decided to become famous by being dumb. And there's almost like a, you know, kind of forgiveness there that you say, he just really is genuinely stupid. These are not stupid people. And that's the second point I was going to get to, which is, I think this is a post-Trump survival strategy. I think that Newsmax and Malkin and a lot of these other folks, they've decided that if Trump loses, they still have to have a grift that will literally shake money out of the pockets of the Trump faithful, you know? And the only way you do that is by being extreme and incendiary and convince all these people that if Trump loses, win or lose, that, you know, the elites are out to get them and that you've got to send us money and keep clicking on our stuff. And I really think they've just decided, I think, you know, this explains Kayleigh McEnany, it explains Malkin, it explains a lot of these people that have just gone completely into the sewer pipe for Trump, because it's going to be the way they're going to make a living when all this is over.
There are so many grifts. Okay, so I want to pull back, and I want to get to your piece in The Atlantic, which is generating a tremendous amount of response, questioning, you know, the manliness. What does, yeah, Donald Trump, the most unmanly, I got to scroll up because the most unmanly president. Why don't the president's supporters hold him to their standard of masculinity? And I want to get to that in a minute. But I wanted to get what has been going through your mind, in your head, over the last week as the author of a book about the death of expertise. We talk about, you know, there's been this attack on expertise, the lack of respect, and bad things could happen. Does it feel like you're seeing like a bizarro version of what you wrote about playing out in real time? I mean, do you ever have moments where you go, okay, part of me likes being proven right, but part of me is like, oh shit, I was like way righter than I thought.
Yeah.
You know what I'm getting at?
I said that to my wife yesterday, you know, because the book is once again selling and, you know, people are buying a lot of copies and people are asking me about it. And I just shook my head and I said, you know, I'd have been perfectly happy to just, you know, hang here in Rhode Island and eat lobster rolls and hang out with my cat and not sell more books right now about this, because, you know, there's a pandemic. There's a cost in human lives. And it does feel to me like the Coen brothers took my book and made a movie out of it.
This was exactly what I was thinking about it.
You know, a really dark, that the Coen brothers got together and said, hey, let's take this book about how dumb people are, you know, and how people hate experts, and let's turn it into this really dark thing about a global pandemic that kills hundreds of thousands of people.
If they showed you a script, if they made a movie out of your book and they showed you the script, you'd go, okay, guys, okay, it's going to be bad, but I mean, this is over the top. Really? Right, it's not going to be that. It's going to be this like this.
To Hollywood, guys, you know, go back to the drawing board. And the thing I didn't count on, because I talked about this and my friend Alex Hefner did an interview with me a couple of years ago and he pulled it up and he said, you know, you predicted a pandemic as part of this problem, like two or three years ago. And he found the clip. And I'd been saying that on the road everywhere I went about, look, a pandemic, a depression, a war, these are the things that'll snap us out of it. What I didn't count on is that there would be an entire political party devoted to fighting the experts and to fighting science and rationality about this. I understood, you know, on things like climate change and how many genders are there and when does life begin, science becomes this hockey puck that the right and the left slap back and forth at each other. But I genuinely thought that during a national emergency where we are literally starting to set up, you know, beds in gymnasiums, that everybody would say, All right. We gotta kind of cut the shit here. We gotta get serious. Absolutely not. We are totally not a serious country. And when it comes to that, when you know Schneider's comment about my citizens, fellow citizens having my back, let me try and say one cheerful thing before we move on. I think most of my fellow, certainly where I live here in Rhode Island, everybody's wearing masks. People are doing what they're supposed to do. I just made an appointment for a haircut in Boston where they read me the riot act about here's all the things about how you're going to wear a mask. We're going to take your temperature down the line. I just think that I feel very threatened by a very small minority of people who are determined to make us all sick if that proves them right and helps them win an election. That's the people I don't trust.
Well, and also it gives us the worst of all possible worlds then, because we still have a lot of people who don't feel safe, therefore will not go back and do business as usual. And then, you know, and then you have this group out there that is completely flouting it, which of course adds to the anxiety, but not necessarily enough to give us full herd immunity. So
I just wanted to be clear that I think the kind of people we're talking about are a distinct minority in American society. And I think most American citizens have done their civic duty and have looked out for each other. But you know, the people that are the cosplayers marching around with their balaclavas and their wooden 50 caliber machine guns, you know, they're going to make the rest of us sick, and they're going to prolong this crisis, ironically enough.
Well, that is what's ironic about it. So even as you and I are speaking, before we get into this, I just there's a press briefing, and the press secretary to the president of the United States, standing in the White House, working for the taxpayers, is talking about the whole Joe Scarborough cold case thing.
Christ,
no, here's Maggie Haberman. Press secretary won't directly answer why the president is making these statements. Instead, says that Meek and Joe should be held responsible for what they say about the president, and then references something that Scarborough once said on Imus's show. Who cares? Eli Stokel says she confirms the obvious. Trump is doing this because he's upset at what Joe and Meek say about him on their show. She does not address that his tweets are upsetting the victim's family. And apparently she said it is Joe Scarborough that has to answer these questions. So if there was any part of you or me that was thinking that maybe this heartfelt letter from her husband, you know, might cause them to back off, you know, somebody put their hand on the president's shoulder and says, hey, look, there's an innocent family here. There are children involved here. We really, you know, let's move on to something else. Let's talk about the economy. If you thought that there was some, you know, scintilla of shame left, yeah, forget it.
It's a reminder that everyone who works around this president, including the press secretary, these people are moral black holes. There is not one photon of light that escapes from these people when they're serving Trump in this way. They are moral nullities who will do and say anything that they think is to their advantage. And it's just ghastly.
If you go along with this one, I mean, this is the Faustian bargain. Well, I'll go along with this because I want to be relevant. I'll go along with this. I'll go along with this. If you go along with this, then you're absolutely right. Okay, so this is one of the central mysteries of Trumpism, right? You know, not what's in his tax returns, but why there is this cult of Trump as the Uber man. That there are Americans that think that somehow Donald Trump is restoring manliness and manhood. There are, you know, giving men permission to be men. And you ask this question, you address it, said, you know, you've been baffled by one mystery. Why do working class white men, the most reliable component of Trump's base, support someone who is, by their own standards, the least masculine man ever to hold the modern presidency? So let's just talk about this. Let's leave expertise aside for a moment. You know, what is the masculine mystique of the least masculine man ever to be president?
The more I've thought about it, as I thought about it when I was writing this, I think it's not a mystery anymore, in the sense that they know. They don't really believe that he's a very manly man. I mean, I think that's, you know, part of the problem is that we're taking them at their word that they think Trump is very manly and macho. And I think the fact that they work so hard at saying so is a tell. You know, I don't think you needed that other presidents, you know, guys like Reagan or Bush or, you know, Bush 41, especially fighter pilot, you know, you didn't spend a lot of time saying, hey, let's paint their faces on Rambo's body. You didn't have to kind of do that heavy lifting for them. And I think that in some way they know. But I also think that they've decided that he is manly in the same way that they, and I bring this up in the piece, the analogy I draw is to Howard Stern, the young guys who say Howard's the man, Howard's the kind of guy I want to be because he says anything he wants and he has porn stars stripping in his studio and, you know, he just doesn't care about anything. And I think in some ways they know that this is all stuff that their fathers, their grandfathers, the generations before them would completely disapprove of. And I think that's one of the reasons this piece has gotten the response. I mean, this piece has gotten me more hate mail and, you know, actually supportive mail. You know, it just, the mail's running like, I would say 6-1 positive, but, you know, some really nasty hate mail, people leaving, you know, really lousy tweets. Because I think this one hits them right where they live, because this is the one part where they know deep down somewhere inside, they get it, that this is, that he really is mincy and dainty and fussy and whiny. You know, that he is not in any way a real man, but they've cast him in that role and they have to keep pushing it. And I brought up in the piece, Gorka, Sub Gorka.
Oh, this, Gorka, that's a great segment. Yeah.
You know, Gorka, who I referred to as the Arnold Horshack of this gang of sweat hogs for you older folks who used to watch TV in the '70s, they have to keep plumping him as a manly man because that is the role they chose for him in the culture war. And, you know, the fact that Trump refuses to play that role, they have to kind of retcon it and figure out how to make it look right. But I think they know they're full of crap.
So you're right. Donald Trump is unmanly because he has never chosen to become a man. And so am I right? Essentially, part of his appeal, though, is he tells men that they don't have to grow up, that he basically said gives them permission to be adolescent boors.
I think, you know, some of the people who've criticized, some of the friendlier criticisms were people who said, you know, Tom, I like the piece, but you're leaving out things like racism or you're leaving out misogyny. And my, you know, I am not an expert in men. I have an N of one, that is myself and, you know, people I might've known. I think little boys by their nature are, you know, sexist and racist and just, we're nasty little pieces of work because we're tribal. You know, we have our group, we have the other group. We have our friends, we have our enemies. Girls have cooties, boys are cool. And so I think all that other stuff comes along with the immaturity.
Right. No, and also you don't have to cover every single thing in every single piece.
Yeah. But I don't think it's that they're racist and therefore they forgive Trump's lack of masculinity. I think they indulge in the kind of racism they wouldn't normally have done. I mean, some of these guys, especially the ones that are in their 20s and 30s, these are men who grew up in a much more diverse world. These are guys who work side by side with men of color. This is not like the 55-year-old guy who finally walked in one day and had a Hispanic female supervisor. So they don't have that same excuse. I think this is just, I'm tired of being a grown-up. A friend of mine pointed out recently that Trump, for years, has been a mainstay of rap music.
Yeah.
That rappers love Trump. They put him in, he's been in songs or endless references to him. And, you know, if there was a culture of arrested adolescent development, that's one of them. And I think that tells you something as well, that he's a hero to rappers and to immature white working class men.
Isn't that extraordinary, though, that somebody who is the symbol of arrested development adolescence somehow can turn that into the new role model for being a man? I mean, that's the damage to the culture is so deep, and you'd expect more pushback from all of this. By the way, I'm just looking at your piece right now. I love the quote from Windsor Mann, who's been on this podcast as well, who points out that Trump behaves in a way that many working class men would, in fact, ridicule if they actually paid attention to it. He wears bronzer, loves gold and gossip, is obsessed with his physical appearance, whines constantly, can't control his emotion, watches daytime television, enjoys parades and interior decorating, and used to sell perfume. But here's a factor. I have to say, I know I'm not a psychologist any more than you are, but I have watched some of the adulation of him, and this always puzzles me. And I think that Donald Trump this is one of his reptilian moments, that reptilian cunning, that he understands the importance of having a gorgeous supermodel by his side, that becomes the talisman of his manliness, particularly to this group. How bad can you be if you are, bleeping, in using his words, a supermodel? And throughout his entire career, he has been obsessed with that as the real marker of his manliness. And just watching a lot of these, this working class Trump supporters, they eat this up. They love this. They love the fact that Melania is the most gorgeous woman in the world, and he's got her, and he's right there.
I actually there were a few people who sent me tweets like that saying, well, you're just jealous. You're not banging a supermodel.
Yep. That's a big thing.
I'm in love. I'm happily married. That's the greatest sense of fulfillment. I should say I'm happily married to a very attractive woman, but I'm also, just happily married. And I think it's been kind of a remarkable exhibition on the part of the men who admire him, that in the way they've doubled down in the reaction to this article, they've sort of made my point, the kind of the immature sort of, you're just jealous. They sound like eighth graders defending the bully who scares them.
So let's go back to our theme of really smart people getting caught up in all of this. And one of the smartest people that I know is Victor Davis Hanson, whose work I at one point admired excessively, both his books and his columns. Okay. Yep. And you have a little section in the article, is Trump courageous? Because, being honorable, being courageous, being, respectful for women, accepting responsibility, these are all markers of being a man. And you point out that courtiers like Victor Davis Hanson have compared Trump to the great heroes of the past, including George Patton, Ajax, and the Western gunslingers of the American cinema. Okay, explain that to me. How do you look at this whiny man-child if you are as smart and as literate and as historically grounded as Victor Davis Hanson and go, Ajax, George Patton?
I think this is another one of those cases where a guy, and I don't know Victor Davis Hanson, but like you, I admired his work. I gave lectures on the Peloponnesian War for years, where his views were a mainstay of what I worked from. I just had the greatest respect for him. And you can go one of two ways. You can say, well, Victor Davis Hanson has finally become completely unhinged by, immigration in California, and now he doesn't know the difference between reality and fantasy. Or, and I think this is the much more likely outcome, he said, Trump is an imperfect vessel for getting done some terrible things that I want done. And so I know how bad this looks. And so I have to construct these careful, intellectually elaborate palaces of bullshit about why it's not as bad as it looks for me to admire Donald Trump. And so now, and then I'm just going to turn on the intellectual bloviation machine about Ajax and Patton and, the classical illusions. I can't help but think that Hanson knows what utter nonsense all of this is. But the other thing that's, to go back to our theme about, this Memorial Day and why things feel different, everything I've ever written, I have a teenage daughter, everything I've ever written, I assume one day when I'm gone, as kids will do, my daughter may well look back at everything I've written to kind of reconstruct what kind of a man was my dad, right? What, 16, my daughter didn't pay a lot of attention to me because she's a teenager. I assume sometime later in life, as kids do, she'll say, I wonder what my dad thought about X, Y, or Z. I cannot imagine leaving a documentary record behind me the way these people are doing. That, you know, that Hansen's grandchildren or the children of some of these, or, you know, it does, I don't even know if Malkin has children, but, you know, that some future generation to say, oh yeah, my dad or my mom, my grandmother, they were the people who tormented the family of a dead woman, you know, in the national media because it was funny and it gave them something to talk about, to help their political candidate. I mean, how can you leave that behind for the people in your own family, the people who love you, who are going to try to figure out what kind of person you are? How does Victor Davis Hanson, to go back to your point, Charlie, how does Hanson take a lifetime of distinguished work and end it by saying this effete, mobbed up, whiny little boy from New York is Ajax?
Add this to our mysteries. Okay, you know? So as I'm listening to you, I mean, I have been thinking about this a lot in terms of there are lots of ways of. I mean, I was actually reading something recently of some 1930s isolationists and appeasers, and the ones who wrote the sort of snarky Federalist of the Day type thing, mocking Churchill or mocking people who took, you know, Hitler seriously. That stuff, nobody reads that anymore. Nobody remembers that anymore. It's just sort of like consigned to a black hole. But even more urgent, even without getting to the of what a future generation is going to say, I know a lot of people who are going to who voted for Donald Trump and will probably vote for Donald Trump again. And many of them are church-going, happily married men who are raising sons. Yeah. And to a person, they want to be good fathers, and they would don't want their sons to grow up to be anything like Donald Trump. They understand, in any other context, they understand honor, sportsmanship, courage, truthfulness, all of these things. And yet somehow, they will vote to enable Donald Trump to be the role model in chief for another 4 years. And I find that just extraordinary. How do they explain to their sons right now, today, that, yes, I think this guy should be the president of the United States, the guy that clearly has no loyalty, who is cruel, who is mean, who is dishonest? How do they do that other than by creating this absolutely fantasy world, this alternative reality where, you know, their sons and never know? You know what I'm saying? I mean, how do you look at the reality? How today, if you know that Donald Trump is doing this about Joe Scarborough, how do you possibly defend this in any way? But Gorsuch, judges, you know?
I think if I will try and speak through the voice of what I think one of these guys would say. And by the way, for me, it was the opposite problem. Part of my, you know, part of my Trump derangement syndrome, you know, which I gladly cop to whenever anybody accuses me of it, is that I have a teenage daughter, and she asked me after Trump was elected, she said, "Is this okay now?
Yeah.
You know, boys can talk this way. This is the president. This is, you know," she was like barely 14 years old. She's like, "Dad, this is all right now." And I said, "No, none of this is okay. And none of it will ever be okay." I think if you ask those guys what they'd say to their sons, they'd say, "Son, this guy, he's kind of a bad guy, and I don't want you to be like him. You know, he's funny, and he used to be on TV, so a lot of the things he says are kind of rude, and I wouldn't want you to be like that because he's just acting. But you know, son, he's really protecting you. He's protecting the country we loved because you know, the academics and the Hispanics and the abortion lovers, they're trying to take this country away from you. So I had to kind of vote for this guy for you, my boy." And of course, you know, that misses the point that what makes a country is the behavior of the people in it. If you want a country that is virtuous, if these guys especially want one where, you know, men are men, well, the first thing they can do is they can act like men. They can act like mature, self-controlled men. You cannot get someone else to do it for you. But I think that is the line of crap they would peddle to their own
kids. I think you're right. Let me just take this one more step, because I'm trying to think about the sort of that cognitive division. Like, yes, we're going to support this, but this has nothing to do with our lives. It's a little bit like, and maybe since we are now into the entertainment culture and politics has become entertainment, you know, you watch a TV show where people behave, or, you know, a miniseries where people behave in a horrible manner. And, you know, they're engaging in, you know, murder and betrayal and incest, and you can still root for them. But then again, when you turn off that movie, when you walk out of the movie theater, whatever, that certainly is not a guide for how you live. And I wonder if we sort of have now decided that politics is in that category. It's almost like this fictionalized world where we can immerse ourselves in. It's like watching Game of Thrones. Were you we talked about this before. Are you a Game of Thrones fan or not?
No, but I am familiar with the canon.
Okay, so you know what I'm saying. You can enjoy that without thinking, hey, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to, you know, behead the local, you know, strongman or whatever type thing. Do you understand what I'm getting here? So one of the consequences will be that we think of government and politics in a completely different way, as divorced from the lives that we lead, in a way that in the long run cannot really be healthy.
Because we want to win. We just want to feel good. We want to feel empowered and come home at the end of the day and say, you know, so I had to do a job that I didn't like, and a guy, you know, at work barking at me, and, you know, my kids are crying. But, you know, if I can go online, and I think social media has been integral to this, even though very few people are actually on places like Twitter, Facebook, and other places, I think it has been really had an outsized impact on the moral corrosion of the Trump voters. If I can go out there and just own the libs for 1 minute, no matter how terrible it is, it feels so good to do that. You know, that one hit of crack, even though I know I'll regret it, and I'm gonna end up with, you know, this rush of meth from being terrible. It's gonna ruin my teeth, and I'm gonna die young, and I don't care. For that one moment, that's what I want. And I think it's a sign of, you know, again, a very adolescent, very juvenile society where we don't think about what is it that, I mean, I don't want to get overly philosophical here, Charlie, but I think we don't think about what is it that makes life worth living. Is it that I love my children, I have my community, I care about my wife, my husband, you know, I volunteered, I shoveled my neighbor's walk, whatever it is. No, these people live to just get over on somebody else in the most brutal and satisfying juvenile way possible.
Okay, so I'm going to assume that you are a really better person than I am, because I understand.
Not all in there, Charlie.
I am, but let's go along with this. That we understand the impulse that when someone hits us, that we get angry, and that we can become vicious, and that there are various ways of saying, I hate this person and I want to hurt them in the worst possible way. But over the years, there's generally someone. So I'm saying I understand the impulse. I get that. But over the years, there are people who put their hand on your shoulder, say, take a deep breath. Do you want to do this? Do you understand what the consequences will be? Do you understand the other people you will hurt? Do you understand who this makes you and what you will become if you do this? Now, what you'll see on Twitter are the number of people who don't have that anchor, who don't have that hand on their shoulder, who would, I hate Charlie Sykes, so therefore I'm going to say the cruelest possible thing about him. I hate Tom Nichols. I'm going to say the cruelest, meanest possible thing about him. And there's Donald Trump deciding, I hate Joe Scarborough. And what is the cruelest, most hurtful thing I can say? I can accuse him of murdering this young woman. And you would hope that, you know, before you get anywhere near any position of responsibility, that somebody would have said, really, you don't want to do that. And here we are living in this world where Donald Trump is pure, raw, hateful id. And I just see it playing out on social media. I see so many people who figure, if he can do it, I can do it too.
It's the same. And I wrote about this in The Death of Expertise. It's narcissism. I mean, that is the disease that is killing us, that we have, you know, for multiple generations been taught that what we think, what we feel, is the most important thing. We have no sense of mission. I shouldn't say we. I mean, the kind of people we're talking about. No sense of mission to anybody else. These are the same people who think it's awesome to torment the family of this dead woman, and then say, when you say, why would you do that? And they say, well, I'm doing it for the babies, because I'm against abortion, because I'm very pro-life, and I care about God.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so you're willing to be this moral dumpster fire of a human being because you've chosen this one issue that the rest of the time you feel compensates you for being a terrible human.
Yeah, but they
being.
Put it in boxes. Again, it's cognitive division. Right. You put this in this box. So yes, because I want to uphold the values of family and right to life over here in this box, I'm going to behave in this incredibly vicious, insensitive way over here because I need to win. Well,
to go back to manliness, this is a very, it's not just a manly virtue. This is an American virtue that, you know, Americans for years were socialized in the great saying, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game, right?
Right.
That it's the point, how you win things. And over the years, tried to explain this to Trump voters that even if he does things that you or I, that Charlie or Tom might like, we are not willing to pay the price of how we're getting them. And so the win isn't worth the cost of how we're getting them. And instead of saying win or lose is how you play the game, Trump's created a whole, or I shouldn't say created, Trump is the patron saint of a large group of people who say, show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser.
This has become a major theme, and it is, you know, and frankly, once you get to whatever it takes to win, if it means suppressing votes, if it means lying, if it means smearing people, then you are really in a different political culture. Okay, I have one question that's really been nagging at my reading the piece. Yeah, I was saying, go ahead, please.
Just one comment on that, Charlie, which is, think of how the place we've gotten to where people say, I take the positions I do because I am trying to save America. And if I have to burn the Constitution to do it, I'll do it. I mean, they don't understand the contradiction that if I have to violate the Constitution and cheat in an election to quote unquote save America, well, then that's just what I've got to do. Well, if you've done that, then you've saved nothing. You've accomplished nothing. You've become the thing that you feared.
Yeah, there's so many ways I could go on all of this. Yes, and you find your sunken costs are so great. You've gone so far into doing this that when it occurs to you that you are burning down the things that you most value, it's too late because you're part of the team, right? You're part of that tribe. You want to stay relevant. So as a subset of this question about manliness, you, of course, teach at the War College, although do not speak for them. Which, by the way, I thought somebody was taking a shot at you on this. I don't know if we've ever spoken where you have not had a disclaimer about the fact that you do not represent the War College when you talk about stuff like
that. You didn't even introduce me that way. But
no.
So that everybody doesn't have a meltdown, I am here. In fact, I happen to be on vacation today, and I'm here on my own time speaking with you in a personal capacity as an American citizen exercising my First Amendment rights, which amazingly I still have right now.
Do you ever think they're going to come after you in a second term?
Oh, it's art. I mean, that, you know, they, even before he was elected, there were people trying to get me fired and filing complaints. And, you know, this is the most thuggish bunch of McCarthyists I've ever seen. And, you know, for years, one thing, whatever my flaws as a human being, I don't think anybody would ever say I'm shy or reticent or hesitant to share my views. And, you know, I have gone after Bill Clinton. I have gone after Barack Obama, hammer and tongs. As a conservative, I was brutal about Obama. I had some beefs with George W. Bush, but fewer. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, this is really, you know, kind of Russia level stuff about trying to, you know, go after your career, fired. Harassment. I have argued with Putinists, Assadists, you know, every political group there is out there. Only the Trumpers try to make this as personal and as difficult as possible. Forget about manliness. It's just un-American. And one of the reasons I keep speaking out is because of the kind of threat these people represent. That just redoubles my commitment to say, you know, you cannot back down to these bullies. Yeah. You have to be speaking out and using your First Amendment rights. So
this is what I want to ask you about, because there is a cult, and I don't know what the numbers are recently, of people in the military who really, really like him. And in terms of manliness and leadership qualities, as you point out, you know, one of the questions you asked about a man is, does Trump accept responsibility and look out for his team, Not in the least. In this category, he exhibits one of the most unmanly of behaviors. He's a blamer. He's a blamer. Nothing is ever his fault. In the midst of a disaster, he praises himself while turning on even his most loyal supporters without a moment's hesitation. Men across America who are socialized by team sports, whose lives are predicated on the principle of showing up and doing the job, continually now excuse a man who continually excuses himself. I mean, wow. So explain that, because this would be the one thing that if you're talking about a sergeant, a lieutenant, a captain, a major, a colonel in the army who behaved like this, they would not have the respect of any of their men. They would be drummed out, wouldn't they?
Well, you know, this is a good time to point out that honestly, Charlie, and I say this, you know, hand to God, I don't know what my students or most of the people I know in the military think about Trump, because where I work, it would be illegal to ask that question. And we're busy. We have courses to teach. We have material that is required by the Defense Department to get through. And we don't sit around talking about who did you vote for and yeah. What do you I've had students ask me, hey, you know, can I ask you about this piece you wrote or what do you think about X? And I say, you know what? If you want to buy me a beer, take me out for a coffee, you know, off duty, off campus, have a normal conversation. Yeah. But in
so what's your theory? Not talking about your student. Well, what is your theory on this?
But the thing is this, I know that I've worked around the military for a quarter century or more. None of this is leadership that would be taught by the military, by corporate leaders, by, you know, leaders of social movements or political parties. I mean, this is not in any way leadership. And again, I find it baffling that people in all walks of life who say, well, he's a real leader. He doesn't take responsibility for anything. Nothing is ever his fault. I mean, one of the most important things a leader can do is owning it when things go wrong. You and I are old enough to remember Ronald Reagan after Iran-Contra, and I can still remember the line. He says, I told you 3 weeks ago that we didn't do this, but my heart said that's true. The facts say otherwise.
Oh, man. That's amazing. He said,
I know I told you this, and it turns out I was wrong. I did it. I read this report. I'm owning it. I screwed up. You know, that is a really important, even Jimmy Carter, a president, neither one of us, you know, probably has a lot of terribly nice things to say about Desert One happens. Carter doesn't go out there and say, you know, those helicopters, they were built by Nixon. Yeah. I only good helicopters. You know, he just said, I ordered it. It was me. It happened. That's the way it goes. And this guy, I don't understand how anyone, but men in particular and men of our shared cultural background, I don't understand how they admire a guy who says, I take no responsibility at all. In the piece I quoted from the movie Apollo 13, a line that has become iconic to the point where it's like on refrigerator magnets, right? Failure is not an option. We have replaced that with, I take no responsibility at all. And I think it's purely because he's my guy. He triggers you. I got an email today from somebody who said, literally said, I don't care if he takes a crap on the desk in the Oval Office, as long as he's making you angry. I got one of those emails.
You probably get one of those every day. I mean, that's almost like the background noise of my life. So
yeah, less often now. I think they sort of just kind of accepted it. But this piece triggered a lot of the he hates you, and that's good enough for me. And yeah. Again, that's how little boys think.
Exactly.
That's how kids in gangs think.
So the piece is in the Atlantics. You got to go. You got to read the whole thing, even if you think you know what the answer is. Donald Trump, the most unmanly president. Why don't the president's supporters hold him to their own standard of masculinity? And I think we can agree that remains a mystery. Tom Nichols, thanks for coming back on the podcast. We always enjoy it when you come on.
Thanks for having me back, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.